are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months.
Always for them, duty, honor, country.
Has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba.
The war in Vietnam.
We will not turn, we will not falter, and we will not fail.
Welcome to the American Military History Podcast. I'm your host, Justin, and this is episode 40, The Battle of Saratoga, part 2, Freeman's Farm. This will be part 37 of our series on the Revolutionary War. This is just a quick reminder that this podcast is fully listener-supported. If you feel that this episode is worth a dollar or two, consider donating to support the podcast. More information can be found at the end of this episode or on the homepage, AmericanMilitaryHistoryPodcast.com. Once there, click on the green button that says support the podcast for more information. When our last episode ended, we saw British General Howe and the new American commander in the North, Horatio Gates, a mere 4 miles apart. The Americans had already established a strong position, which, if you'll recall, was shaped like a three-sided square, or a U-shape if you take away the curves, whatever is easier for you to visualize there. At the center of Gates' position, the command was Brigadier General Ebenezer Learned, and that group of soldiers he was commanding was made up of Learned's own brigade of Continentals, plus Colonel Livingston's New York Regiment, and the Massachusetts Continental Regiments of Colonels Bailey, Jackson, and Wesson. The right wing, which had a larger contingent of artillery when compared to the other two, was comprised of Brigadier Generals Glover and Patterson's units. This wing's position dominated the ground sloping down to the river and remained under the personal command of Gates. The left wing was under command of someone that we've spoken about at great lengths, Major General Benedict Arnold. Arnold's forces were comprised of the New Hampshire Continental Regiments of Colonels Silly, Hale, and Scammell, as well as New Yorkers under Colonels Van Cortlandt and Livingston, Connecticut Militia under Colonels Latimer and Cook. Last but not least was Colonel Daniel Morgan's Corps of Riflemen. If you'll recall from our last episode, Gates had taken Daniel Morgan and his riflemen and a few other various riflemen from various other units and comprised this almost elite corps of, I don't want to say sharpshooters or snipers, because I don't want you to get the wrong idea about them. They were actually a group of infantry that were very good shots and possessed weapons that was, you know, 3 to 4 times the effective range of the muskets. So it's an infantry unit that is considered more advanced than some of the others. Gates was deployed, and he was on good ground, and he knew it too. Gates was content to sit and wait on Burgoyne's next move. Gates' intelligence was also significantly better than that of Burgoyne's, which we talked about in our last episode as well, and that was partly due to the fact that his Indian scouts had all left him after the Battle of Bennington. Gates's intelligence on Burgoyne's movements were so good that he quickly knew when they were making major movements. Historian Samuel W. Patterson says of Gates's intelligence, quote, "Wisdom favored General Gates's decision to bide his time. He was strongly entrenched, his troops disposed to advantage, their morale never better. He kept a watchful eye and a listening ear at his headquarters." By Thursday, 18th of September, 1777, Burgoyne had completed his plans for the next day's operations. His plan involved an advance upon his enemy's position with around 3/4 of his effective fighting strength, which would be around 4,200 out of his 6,000 men. Those men would be deployed into 3 columns. The maneuver was intended to either be a reconnaissance mission or a 3-pronged attack. depending upon the enemy's position, which Burgoyne had a decent, but not a clear idea of. The British order of battle was based upon a center and two wings. The left wing was commanded by Riedesel, who was accompanied by General Phillips. The wing's strength came to around 1,100 men, composed mainly of three Brunswick infantry regiments, followed by Captain Pouch's 6 6-pounders and 2 3-pounders of artillery. 6 companies of the British 47th guarded the bateau with the army's stores. Riedesel's mission was to move south along the river and attack the American right. The center force was another 1,100 men, give or take, under Hamilton, and it was made up of all the battalion companies of the 9th, 20th, 21st, and 62nd British regiments. Their artillery support, under Captain Jones, included 3 6-pounders and 3 3-pounders. Burgoyne chose to accompany this force, which was to make a frontal attack in the center. The right wing was under General Fraser, and it had the mission of enveloping the American left by seizing the high ground to the west of the fort. Fort Nielsen, which was a farm known as Nielsen's Farm that had been fortified by American forces. If he was able to capture the fort, Fraser would be able to dominate the American fortifications with his artillery while it supported his assault against them. If successful, he could drive the Americans back against the river and envelop their rear. Fraser had a brigade of artillery for the job, 4 6-pounders and 4 3-pounders. The infantry of his wing included the light infantry companies of 10 British regiments, plus the grenadier companies of the same 10 regiments. In addition, Fraser had the battalion companies of the British 24th, as well as Lieutenant Colonel Brayman's Brunswick riflemen. Because Fraser commanded the advance corps, his wing also included 50 Indians, about 150 Loyalists, 80 Canadians, and about 50 British marksmen. The early morning of September 19th was cool and foggy, but by 11 a.m. the sun had broken through and it had become a fine September day. A signal gun boomed and started the British columns in motion. By about 1 p.m., the heads of Riedesel's columns had slowly advanced southward until they were at a point about 1.5 miles to the east of Freeman's Farm. While Riedesel was moving southward, Fraser was making good time marching towards the west. His column headed due west until it had passed the head of the Great Ravine, continued on for 1.5 miles until it reached a T-junction with the road running south towards Bemis Heights. Fraser made a column left at the junction, marched south, then halted on some high ground about 1/2 mile west of Freeman's Farm. There he waited, apparently for action in the center or word from Burgoyne. Hamilton's column in the center followed in the tracks of Fraser's column for 1.5 miles, then moved left, which would be southward, on a road that eventually turned westward to cross the bottom of the Great Ravine over a bridge that was miraculously still intact. And I say miraculously here because, as we learned, the Americans had decimated the countryside. They had chopped down trees over roads so that you couldn't pass the road. They had burned farm fields, etc. Burgoyne, who was traveling with Hamilton in an overall command, halted the force at noon on the other side of the ravine to give Fraser time to get into position. The movements of the British and their bright scarlet-colored uniforms moving through the woods were easily spotted by the American scouts and patrols throughout the morning, all of which was reported to Gates, who continued to sit tight and hold his position. He wanted Burgoyne to come to him. Benedict Arnold, ever the traitor, didn't agree with Gates' plan. We've known Arnold and our other conversations about him, and what we know about him is that he's a man of action. He's not one to sit idly by, so this sitting around and waiting on Burgoyne to come to them has got to be eating at him, and it is. And, you know, Arnold decides that he understands what's coming his way. He's faced it before, and he's pleaded with Gates to take action. If not on all fronts, then at least let Arnold take out the threat to the enemy's left flank, or its left front, which would be Fraser's forces. Arnold's arguments were not that of a man who just was, you know, tied up with bloodlust. His arguments were actually very logical. He stated that if Burgoyne was allowed to get a force with artillery on the height to the west of the American position, he could easily attack after an artillery preparation, and if he was successful in penetrating the defensive lines, he could drive the defenders into the Hudson River. Now, if that sounds familiar, that's because it's the exact plan that Burgoyne is trying to get his forces to do. Arnold has been able to predict it, mainly due to his experience as a battlefield commander. Now, on the other hand, if Burgoyne were to be attacked right now, the battle would be carried to him, where, entangled in the woods, his troops could not maneuver, nor would their artillery be effective. There, the Americans, with superior firepower, would be at their best. According to Charles B. Todd in his work, The Real Benedict Arnold, quote, Arnold begged, stormed, and entreated, but still he could get no orders. At length, Gates consented to let Dearborn's infantry and Morgan's riflemen to go in. And now it also seems, based upon what else we know, that Arnold was allowed to support Morgan with other units of his wing if the situation dictated it. On the British side, once he was in position, British Commander Fraser sent a detachment of Loyalists, Canadians, and Indians to set up outposts in the area just south of Freeman's Farm. The detachment, based upon what we know today, seems to have been haphazardly commanded. About 12:30 in the afternoon, after the mixed force arrived at Freeman's Farm, the command disintegrated. The men began to lie down in the ground or stroll around the open areas of the farm, which was, you know, roughly 20 to 30 acres of farmland at this particular farm, which was not cleared of woods. Now, as these men are lying down and just walking around and having a good, just fancy old time, the woods near the farm erupted with the fire of Daniel Morgan's riflemen, which, if you'll recall from our episodes on rifles, were much more accurate than standard issue muskets and had an effective range that was 3 to 4 times as large. Morgan's men had set their sights on the unit's officers. Every single officer was struck down, as were many of the men of the unit. The ones that were left took off in a panicked flight. Morgan's riflemen, who had advanced on the enemy position in extremely disciplined silence, almost as if they were hunting game instead of British soldiers, could no longer be contained. They broke away from their firing line and in a mad rush to pursue and slaughter their survivors. Hearing the firing and seeing the fleeing men pass his position, the Loyalist Major Forbes led his own detachment forward in an organized counterattack, and Morgan's men, caught off guard with their units dispersed, were taken aback and driven to the rear. Following in his accustomed place behind the center of his line, Daniel Morgan was dumbfounded to see his troops flee back past him. His surprise turned to instant rage as his notorious temper stepped in and overcame him, but soon he cooled down and began to rally and reform a fighting line at the south end of the clearing. Morgan commanded Dearborn to extend the line to the left, which would be towards the west, which, as Morgan quickly realized, was not far enough to cover the British front opposing it. The problem was soon solved when the ever-resourceful Benedict Arnold hurried up units to Morgan's support. The New Hampshire Continentals of Sillies and Scammell's regiments dashed up into line to the left of Morgan's men. These reinforcements wasted no time in attacking the British right in an attempt to outflank it, but it was repulsed by, quote, a tremendous fire. As Major Henry Dearborn recorded the action in his journal, quote, I ran to his, Major Sillies, assistance with the light infantry, but he was obliged to retreat before I came up. Colonel Scammell's and Hale's regiments then came to our assistance. It was now about 2 o'clock p.m. when a very heavy fire commenced on both sides. The first part of the Battle of Saratoga, regularly referred to as the Battle of Freeman's Farm, had begun. Burgoyne and Hamilton were set to square off against Benedict Arnold's tactical abilities and Morgan's rifles. The clearing at Freeman's Farm was roughly 20 acres. Hamilton had positioned his artillery in the center of the edge of the woods on the northern side. He deployed his infantry regiments in line beside and behind the guns. Now, if nothing else, we can call Benedict Arnold a bold commander. He quickly sized up the situation and saw that a wide gap still existed between Fraser's force and Burgoyne's center at Freeman's Farm. Quickly, he decided to attack the British center, and then, if he could gather enough forces, split the enemy in two and smash each piece in turn. He started forming his attack line as fast as he could rush his regiments into position. Arnold's regiments went forward to strike Hamilton's center and left flank, and now began the fiercest fighting of the battle, which would last about 4 hours. An American penetration of Hamilton's position created a gap in the British line, which forced the individual units to fight, at times, in three directions, in front and on their left and right flanks. Fraser sent 8 British companies, reinforced by riflemen, to support Hamilton. The American assaults failed to break through, and around Hamilton's right, the battle became an exchange of frontal attacks and counterattacks, which surged back and forth, south to north, north to south. The men rolled across the clearing of Freeman's Farm. The fire on both sides was so continuous and intense that the British officers, who had seen and served in some of the greatest and fiercest battles of the Seven Years' War, declared that they had never experienced so hot a fire. The American rifle and musket fire was superior in this clash, and I mean superior in 2 instances. 1, numerically, the Americans outnumbered the British in this engagement. And 2, I also mean tactically. Morgan and other commanders of rifle units had their men, with their more accurate and longer-range rifles, climb into trees and target, and subsequently kill, British officers and artillerymen. Now this brings up an interesting point that we should discuss. There is a myth, and I'm not 100% sure of its origin, that Americans won the war, / it was part of their main battle plan, by killing British officers, like specifically targeting officers and killing them. Now, there's a few things that sit kind of uneasy with me about this myth, and this is kind of why I don't really believe that it's true. Now, it probably started as a myth, because as we see it, it did happen occasionally. Like, I mean, we just saw it happen a few moments ago. Morgan did it. There's no denying that it happened. But it was typically frowned upon. You have to remember that you're still in an era of aristocracy and gentlemen and ladies, and the commanders of these units would typically have been men who had either earned their aristocracy through the military or there was some type of political appointment to giving them command of the units. And that was the same on both sides, both British and American. And so these men had this air of mutual respect for each other, and the commanders themselves, at least, wouldn't intentionally try to kill each other. And it may sound crass, but to them, that's what infantry was for. Let them fight it out. Now, as I mentioned a moment ago, did the Americans do it? Yes. In battle, we see it happen. And we're going to see it happen again at Saratoga. And we're going to see Daniel Morgan's troops do it again. So if it wasn't, it's not as if Washington or Gates or Arnold gave the order to kill the officers. The men just did it. It made the most sense. Now, to be fair, maybe these men did give the order, and we don't see it recorded in history. That could have happened, but I have to go with what we know from a factual perspective. So the net-net that you need to take from this, was this an overall strategy from the top down? Was the targeting and killing of enemy officers an overall strategy? Most likely not. Was it something that happened? Absolutely. Would it happen again in later engagements and battles and wars? Absolutely. Now back to our action here. Although Morgan's rifles were strong, they were eventually beaten back by the British bayonets. If you'll recall from our episode about rifling versus muskets, rifles weren't able to have bayonets affixed to them. So the men were forced to fall back. Then the British launched a full-on counterattack. That counterattack was beaten back by the fierce fire of the Americans. The British artillery pieces would be taken by the Americans, then retaken by the British, then taken by the Americans, etc., etc. Now, the American infantry's fire eventually drove the British back into the woods behind their guns, but the Americans could not turn the captured cannon on their enemy because the gunners had carried their linstocks away when they fled. Now, if you're not familiar with cannons of the time, the linstock actually has nothing to do with moving the cannon, but it has everything to do with firing the cannon. The linstock was a long pole that held the match for lighting the cannon. So without that linstock, you really weren't able to fire the weapon. When British General Phillips, the veteran artilleryman, rode up after leaving Ridesel's wing, he found only one artillery officer alive and unwounded, while 36 of 48, which is 75% of the enlisted artillerymen, were casualties. Phillips sent for reinforcements from Ridesel, who responded at once with four of Captain Pouch's guns. Phillips' actions were not confined to artillery. The British 62nd Regiment in the center was taking punishment far greater than the other three regiments in Burgoyne's center. When it was thrown at the Americans in a bayonet attack, it drove deep beyond supporting distance and lost 25 men as prisoners. Phillips led a supporting attack in person, which freed the 62nd and allowed it to rally and reform. Before the day was over, the 62nd suffered losses of 83%. The other regiments of the center took casualties of 44%. On the American side, Benedict Arnold was getting desperate. His original plan had called for a bold yet powerful strike that would split his enemy, but he had yet been able to deliver that decisive blow that would break through the center and right wing of the British. He's been able to hit them hard, but he hasn't been able to break through. He called for reinforcements, but none would come in time to decide the action in Arnold's favor. Too late in the day, Gates finally released Learned's brigade. Instead of supporting Arnold at Freeman's Farm, where he was so urgently needed, however, Learned made a half-hearted attack on Fraser's wing and was driven off. During the period before Learned had been sent into battle, another British general was acting to intervene decisively. Ridesel, having heard the sounds of continuous firing and sensing Hamilton's perilous situation, decided to risk the loss of the vital supply train and bateau at the river he was guarding by taking part of his wing to the aid of Burgoyne's center. He led off with two companies of the regiment Retz, followed by the entire regiment Ridesel, and Captain Pouch with 2 6-pound guns. The fat German general plunged forward to save the day for the British. Ridesel urged the two Retz companies forward on a trail through the forest for a mile and a half between him and Freeman's Farm until he arrived at the top of a hill where he could see the clearing. What he saw made him all the more eager to get into the action. The long, solid line of three British regiments had been reduced to small groups, quote, surrounded by heaps of dead and wounded, and yet the unwounded were still firing. Ridesel saw that every minute counted, and he attacked with his leading companies without waiting for his own regiment to come up. With his men shouting and drums beating, he fell in the American right flank that had rested on the north branch of the Great Ravine. Ridesel's piecemeal attack caught the Americans by surprise and drove them back into the woods. The attack was soon supported by Captain Pouch's two guns, which had basically been carried through the forest and up the slopes until they could be gotten into firing position. German Jaegers, aided by British soldiers and even officers, helped the artillerymen man the drag ropes to get the guns up. This was essentially they tied ropes to the cannon and pulled it up the hill. That's as complex as the technology gets. They pretty much manhandled it through the woods. Pouch opened fire with grape shot, which again is like buckshot, which quickly decided things on the battlefield. Regiment Riedesel finally came up panting and fired its first volley. Burgoyne then launched the whole force, Germans, British, whatever he had available, in a last desperate push. The Americans were able to resist at first, then began withdrawing. It was growing dark, and the American hope of smashing the British had faded with the light of day. The British still held the field, but at a massive cost. The overall loss to Burgoyne's army was 600 killed, wounded, or captured. Of the 600, 350 came from the three British regiments in the center. American losses, out of forces outnumbering the British by 2-1, were 65 killed, 218 wounded, and 36 missing. Burgoyne had paid the price for dispersing his combat power in difficult terrain. Only Riedesel's willingness to take a calculated risk saved Burgoyne's center from complete destruction. On the American side, Gates's indecisiveness lost the opportunity to smash his enemy on this first day of battle. As things add up, Benedict Arnold deserves credit not only for bringing on the battle, but for leadership in directing the American forces through the battle. If Burgoyne had continued to attack the next day, on the 20th of September, things may well have gone his way. The American forces were in dire need of reorganization, and an effective strike could have changed the turnout of the battle. Burgoyne actually wanted to attack the next day, but Fraser insisted that his light infantry and grenadiers needed a day's rest before continuing the attack. Now, the men needed a day of rest because they had done relatively nothing except watch the men in the center engage in battle. Now, Burgoyne listened and agreed to hold up operations. On the 21st of September, Burgoyne's army was ready to fall in and advance to the attack, but its commander was busy going over a dispatch received from Sir Henry Clinton, who was commanding British forces in New York. The letter was dated 9 days earlier, the 12th of September. It informed Burgoyne that Clinton was going to make a push northward against the American forts along the river. Gates might therefore be forced to weaken his forces on Bemis Heights in order to send a significant number southward, thus enabling Burgoyne to advance again at the right time. So Burgoyne called off his attack and orders his units to dig in along the same general lines that they had occupied while awaiting the results of Clinton's operations. It would prove to be a fatal decision, because in doing so, Burgoyne had given up his last chance at maneuvering against his enemy or retreating back to Ticonderoga. He was pinned down, and his supplies were running out. And we'll talk about that on our next episode. Maybe. I need you guys to tell me. We've got two options. I can finish the story of Saratoga and then talk about Clinton's campaign in the North, which would be a little bit out of order chronologically. Or I could take a break here, talk about Clinton's campaign for one episode, and then pop back down and finish up our conversation on Saratoga. So I need you, my listeners, shoot me a tweet, send me a message on Facebook, email me through the website's contact form, and let me know which way you want to go. Do we finish Saratoga, or do we go to Clinton's campaign in the North? And after you let me know what you want next week's episode to be, consider if today's episode was worth a dollar or two. And if it was, why not head over to the website and donate to support the podcast? Visit AmericanMilitaryHistoryPodcast.com and click on the green button that says support the podcast. There, you'll be able to give recurring donations with Patreon or single or recurring donations with PayPal. This podcast is listener supported, so every little bit helps, even if you're just buying me a cup of coffee. And normally that's where I say listener supported coffee, but it is 11:04 on Wednesday night. I am not drinking coffee right now. And as you can tell, my voice is kind of going. I've been going all day, so I'm going to try and get this episode finished. I'd like to thank my donors this week. Matt T. donated at the corporal level, and he left me a note telling me to get some coffee. I think Matt's donation is going to go to a veteran-owned coffee company. From what you guys have told me on Twitter, it looks like Ranger Coffee or Black Rifle Coffee, or maybe I'll just buy a bag of coffee from each of them. Thanks to all of my donors for the support you give. It helps keep the podcast running. As well as to all of my recurring donors, thank you for your donations this month. If you do donate, you get your name on the website, and you also get mentioned on future episodes. To stay up to date with the podcast, you can follow it on Facebook and Twitter, or with the email newsletter. Links to all of those are on the website, or you can search Facebook and Twitter for American Military History. Thanks to all of you that follow me on the Twitter account that I have, which is at AMH Podcast. And thank each and every one of you that retweeted me this week. That would be at JimYat11, at JerseyVapeGeek, at JakeM, at ScubaPirate80, at Villain70, at RodAnyaw, at McKeel88, at Jordan T. Jansen, at M. Lunyon, at Extra Dividends, at JSD82C, at John Buck, at Fight Aaron Fight, at Ritterton. If you would like the illustrious honor of having your Twitter name mentioned here, just simply retweet one of my tweets to your followers. It's that simple. This week saw two more 5-star reviews in the iTunes store from Archer Lou and Small Falls Peter. Thanks to you guys for reviewing the podcast. That brings us up to 72 total ratings. That's awesome. Our next target is 75. That is only 3 away. Let's make this happen today. I have a service that actually lets me generate images of my iTunes reviews, and I actually tweeted one out tonight. This would be Wednesday night, the 23rd. I'm going to start doing that more. That's kind of a way for me to give back and engage with you guys. So if you leave a review, I'm going to try and grab the picture of it and tweet it out to, you know, all my followers on Twitter. Now, several of you have left me voicemail messages. I think I have two that I need to look at. I apologize. They're not going to be at the end of this episode. I am outside of work and podcasting. I am coaching baseball for my oldest son, who is 8, and my middle son, who is 5. So I have a peewee or a coach's pitch, depending on, you know, where you live. They call it different things. Baseball team that I'm coaching, and I have a t-ball team that I'm coaching. So I am on a baseball field about 5 nights a week right now. So time is definitely a commodity. So I wanted to make sure that I get the episode out there, and I will get to those voicemail messages that you left. So look for that in an upcoming episode. So I wish I could tell you what we're going to talk about next week, but that is up to you. Remember to send me a tweet or leave me a message on Facebook and let me know which direction you want to go. Until then, take care.